Hello, and welcome to episode 83 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. This week on the show, I am joined by Mayor Cervenick, former elementary school teacher in New Jersey, now consultant and recent podcast host. I recently heard her on the Ed Podcast with Shane Lawrence, and after hearing her story, I immediately messaged her about 15 minutes into the episode and asked her to join me on the podcast. Before you listen to this episode, I highly recommend that you take a listen to Conversation 84 of the Ed Podcast. Mayor and I do a surface overview of her story in this episode, but on the Ed Podcast, she gets deep into what happened to her. It is a fascinating and eye-opening listen, and I really think you will appreciate it. You can find that episode by clicking the link in the show notes or looking for the Ed Podcast or Ed Conversations in iTunes. Mayor and I talk about some of the politics of school and how they can impact teachers, the concerns with the people holding the money and micromanagement of teachers, how the ants outnumber the grasshoppers, how teachers need to speak up about the problems we are facing in schools, the problems with public behavior charts and archaic practices that just will not go away, and how your students will always remember the way you make them feel, even when they don't remember what you taught them. I also need to point out that the sound quality is not the best for the episode. I made a really obvious and silly mistake when recording this, and so I sound kind of far away throughout a lot of the episode. 83 episodes in, you would think I would have a better handle on things, but nope. The content is still compelling though, so I hope my sound won't dissuade you from listening. So, sit back and enjoy episode 83 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Mayor Cervenick. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Treffler, and I'm really excited today. You know, as many of you probably know, if you've listened to the show, Shane Lawrence has been on here a couple of times. He is the host of the Ed Podcast, and last month I listened to an episode of his show, and I think I was probably about 15 minutes in before I messaged the guest and said, "You have to be on my show. Your story is amazing, and I want you to come talk to me." And then I continued to listen to the podcast and was like, "Yeah, I definitely made the right choice." And so here we are a couple weeks later and finally lined up the scheduling, and I'm joined by Mayor, I'm going to totally screw up your last name.
You won't, I promise.
Before we started, Mayor Cervenack.
You did it.
Woohoo. Hey, Mayor, how's it going tonight?
It's going good. This is so late for, you know, it's so funny. I always describe myself as like a total grandma at night because 9 o'clock, even like I would say 8:45, I am in bed. I grab my cat. We are like off to bed with like a face mask on. And so this is late for me. I really hope I'm coherent in this interview.
You know, my first response was we are total opposites. But then I just started to wonder if your cat also wears a face mask.
My cat wears a face mask. Of course. Of course.
Obviously.
He's my little prince.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I appreciate you staying up late then past your bedtime to come chat with me.
Of course, and
have a little chat here about education tonight.
So, absolutely.
You know, for my audience, it is actually only 9 o'clock, so it's not actually all that late. But you know, we'll go with Mayor time tonight.
Yeah, that's fine. Let's just pretend it's much later.
So, Mayor, I do appreciate you joining me on the show. For my audience who does not listen to the Ed Podcast and has not heard who you are, would you mind giving me a quick introduction to yourself?
Absolutely. I'm a teacher, or I was a teacher for 10 years in New Jersey, an elementary school teacher. So I do a lot of work on Twitter, and I find I have to clarify that sometimes because I don't realize how different that world is from middle and high school. So I taught in elementary ed. It was my second career. I was in the corporate world, went straight out of college, and then had my first daughter and didn't really want to go back to the corporate world. So I stayed home for 7 years with my kids, and during that time, went back to get my master's and started teaching and just was done in my ninth year. I was checked out. I was ready to go. And I got offered a position to work for the Department of Education here in the state. So I went there and I was a director of their professional learning network. So, and now I'm here trying to kind of do my own thing, do some consulting and coaching for teachers. I mean, that's where my passion is. And start my own podcast as well. So,
You know, I was going to bring up the podcast. I was excited because I was pulling up your Twitter feed tonight to make sure I was prepped and ready to go. And I saw that the first episode is out.
It is. It just dropped this week. It dropped on Monday. That's my intention, is every Monday morning to put out a new episode. And I think Shane even kind of gave me that advice, and an individual here in New Jersey, Chris Nessie, he has a podcast as well, House of EdTech, and he was the first person I talked to, and he said, it's never going to be perfect, because I was just holding on to perfect, and I should know better. So I made the trailer, dropped it, made the first episode, dropped it, and then the second one will be out next week.
That's awesome. No, it's, I'm excited. I'm adding it to my list. So I will listen, you know, this episode will be releasing on Friday, and then your next episode will come out in 2 days after that. So it'll be great.
Awesome.
You'll be on here and people can go check out your show. What is the name of your show, just while we're talking about it?
The name of the podcast is called Faculty Room.
Yep. Faculty Room sounds similar to my Ed Break Room as my hashtag. So I like it. We're kindred spirits already.
We are.
We've only just started. I'm excited to talk to you because you have, and if people want to hear your story, they can go back and listen to the Ed podcast as well. But, you know, it's been a journey for you to have sort of left education and still sort of love it. I love it that you are going to be able to give a perspective, as we discussed tonight, I'm sure, as someone who was in education directly and now is sort of in an indirect way in the education field. And I think it's such a powerful perspective you're going to be able to provide. I'm excited. I'm pumped. I'm ready to go.
Absolutely. You know, and I talk about, I'm in a really unique position right now. And I think why people that do follow me is, and I even write this on my Twitter page, like I have been to Oz and I know what's behind that curtain, and it is not what people believe it to be. And I'm very open with talking about everything that's right in education are the kids and the teachers and the faculty and the people that really want to do well. And we keep getting bombarded with the things that are wrong, that are not out of our control. And I think that I'm in a unique position now because I don't have to write on my Twitter page, you know, retweets are not endorsements. Like, these thoughts, not only are they mine, but I can say whatever I want. And I don't mind saying that.
It's interesting to me because I've spoken on this show before and I've written about on my blog how I wrote a blog post that was endorsing a product that my district had paid for and provided to my school.
Yeah.
And was very nearly terminated over that blog post that was requested on the behalf of Microsoft and went on their blog. And then I got a cease and desist from our legal team because the district had not approved me writing that blog post about the product that they had provided me. And their reason was that me writing it somehow would say that the district supported the use of that product. And I said, yeah, but you do. You bought.
Right.
I don't understand. And it sort of opened my eyes to, very much like you, I still work in a public school district, but I found those lines where I don't ever mention the name of my district or the name of my school.
Yes. And it's funny. I mean, now I do. And, you know, for those of you that don't know my story, it's such an easier thing to go to Shane's episode because it's such a detailed episode. It's a long story, but 5 years ago, I had tenure charges filed against me for, I wouldn't say nonsense because I did make a mistake, but what they turned it into with four teachers, was just misconstrued, misrepresented. And really, there was an agenda, and there was an agenda, you know, with the superintendent against the union. There was a backstory that was bigger than us and out of our control, but it changed me. Obviously, it affected me tremendously, but when I went back to work after that and we all got our jobs back, you carried yourself a lot differently. There wasn't a casual manner in which you did things anymore. You watched every word you said, you watched everything you did. Because it does, it changes you completely.
Yeah, it you know, I like we said before we started, you don't need to rehash the whole thing, but seriously, yeah. I will link directly to the episode with Shane.
That's perfect. Yeah.
It'll be in the show notes. So if you know how to look at show notes, just swipe over in your podcast player and you can see the link directly to Shane's episode. Also just go listen to the podcast. Any episode is great. And it opens with some rock banjo, which really, how many places can you hear rock banjo? Like, you should hear that. But also his interviews are phenomenal and Shane's great. But I definitely, Mare's episode, it gives a great story. And I think your brief retelling is great. And much of what I take out of your story is that it was taken out of context, you know,
100%,
it's so
yeah.
easy to take something we say out of context in the media. Right. And it's funny how 5 years later, that is so much more poignant, I feel like, probably given current state of affairs in this country.
Even my second interview I did with Shane, and there was a journalist on, and one of my best friends is a journalist, and we were discussing how at this point what you see in the news, and it's so current right now, whether it was that Nick Sandman down in Washington D.C. with the MAGA hat on and Jesse Smollett will put stories out super quick. And then as the story facts come in and drips and drabs, then we'll kind of redo. But we're so quick to get clickbait and to get hits on an article that we're a salacious world right now that just lives for gossip and lives for drama. And I am not in that world. I mean, I look at news a lot differently now after what happened to me because of, I know the story that was in the paper was not the actual story, but it is what it is. I mean, this is just the world we live in. We are so not only quick to judge people, but quick to just watch people be destroyed. And I will never understand that. I have gained so much more empathy and compassion for individuals, even individuals that have done wrong things, and people make mistakes, and then. For those people that will just not let it up, I almost find it so ironic sometimes for the people that will judge people that have made mistakes years ago and keep judging them. I'm not sure that they're that much better than those people that have made the mistakes in the first place. So
probably true. You know, it's funny. There's just recently in the last couple of weeks, John Oliver, who does a late night show on HBO, he did a whole segment on public shaming.
And I saw that. Yeah.
Very much made me because I had just listened to Shane's episode and then watched that. And I said, you know, this is very much what we're dealing with here. So I thought,
you know,
it was,
and it's
interesting.
Absolutely. And it's funny. Even I recently was talking to someone and it was like, the woman I connect with the most is Monica Lewinsky. And it's not that obviously I didn't do what she did, but we killed this poor girl in the media. We decimated her. She was, you know, she had to go hide away and she made a mistake that a lot of people probably would have made. And what we did in the media to her and continue to do with the jokes and just could not let her live it down. And you see this woman now going on tours, talking about bullying, talking about what she did, the mistakes she made, and then how she's overcome it. And I get so much strength from her. I get strength in a lot of people who have made mistakes and are just doing better. And I think that that's the majority of people that have done it. And I have said a million times over, the mistake I made 5 years ago that got me in trouble, I've done worse in my life. I just wasn't in the newspaper for it. And it's just very funny how we judge people, and especially strangers that know nothing about me and the work that I've done and the work that I continue to do. But, you know, this is the world we're in right now.
Yeah, unfortunately that it is.
Yeah.
Man. We're already rocking and rolling, Mare. We're just
I know. I'm sorry to use up your time with all that.
This is not my time. This is your time. This is your time here today. So this is perfect. No, I love it. I think you're already hitting on some strong points. And I'm tempted to drive this conversation in some certain directions, but I kind of feel like I kind of have faith you're going to take them where I want to go when I ask you my question. So I'm going to go to my first question right away and just ask you, the first question I ask all my guests, of course, is what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Oh my gosh. So I think that my biggest problem in education today are the people that have the control of, are in control of the money and in control of the legislation that puts certain practices in place. So when I taught, my issue was when I first started 10 years ago, it was kind of this utopian world. I was teaching what I wanted. We had a curriculum. It was given to us, but there was this freedom to make it your own, to explore text, to teach math in the way that you wanted. And then slowly we got a new superintendent and every program that we were used to teaching was thrown out and these big box company programs were given to us. And we were told, you know, follow the script. We had people coming in to check if we had certain posters that were created by Houghton Mifflin on the wall. We had people call our house phones to check what page number we were on in the social studies text that day. And they would call every classroom. It was a nightmare. And that was coming from the top. That was the person in charge of our district. And even when I look at the state of New Jersey, and the funding that certain schools receive and certain schools don't. Funding is huge. If I talk about the biggest problem in education, it is the money. We are trying to be as equitable as possible. I mean, people throw around equity like it's some hot topic fad word and do nothing to back it up. They printed an article in the US News, I would say two months ago, talking about how New Jersey was like the sixth most segregated state in terms of schools. And when our taxes go towards our local schools, the schools, there's $23 million more going towards white, at predominantly white upper middle class schools. And that's a problem. And when we talk about equity, we need to talk about access, and we are not leveling the playing field, and we're not even attempting to. And that's where my frustration lies all the time, that legislation is being written every day to make politicians feel so much better about themselves and how wonderful they are. These people have no idea what happens inside a public school. They have no idea what the curriculum currently is. And they just write these pieces of legislation to change curriculum without even looking at what currently exists. And they do it and put a stamp on it. And they say, oh, we did our job for the day. And meanwhile, offer no support, no professional learning opportunities, nothing for a teacher to take, whatever that piece of legislation was, and make it better for the kids. Everyone has lost sight of what matters here, and it's about the kids. And for everybody else, this has turned into big business and profits and kickbacks, and it's disgusting to me, and it's destroying what's good about education, and this is why teachers are leaving.
Hmm.
And I'm not really that passionate about it. It just sounded really dramatic that way.
No, I'm just trying to figure out the direction to take it. No, it's wow. It feels even more timely given that we are recording this a week after the new federal budget came out, and we're talking about $7 billion in cuts across the board for education. And, you know, that's a scary thought combined with that. And so much of that cut being put back into non-public schools, it's a little scary, right? You know?
Well, I mean, and the writing was on the wall when DeVos took the job, and we knew where this was going. We have a president in office right now whose son stood at a rally and called us losers. There is no respect for this profession. And this happened in the state of New Jersey 8 years ago when we had a governor that killed us. And we saw this rapid decline of the way we were evaluated. Everything started to just, the heat became hotter on teachers. And right now, you'll put teachers in the news for minor infractions and won't ever report on the work that they do 24 hours a day for their kids. We are one of those professions that has become a joke, something that, you know, we're lazy and summer's off nonsense. And no one's looking at the lack of resources that we deal with every single day. I mean, you have teachers on strike in Los Angeles. You have teachers that are making nothing in Arizona. It's, we're in a bad place. You know, we're just in a really bad place. And the cuts to education, I mean, to me, it was just like, ugh, throw it with the rest of them. They've done nothing to impress me. This administration, I knew, was going to do nothing to impress me. And then in the world of education, they are for private and charter, and public education is losing out once again.
So what do we do? Or let me phrase it differently. What is the path forward? Because maybe there is simply nothing we can do. But what is the path forward? Where do we go from here? And what does that mean?
There is never a moment that I don't think about the movie A Bug's Life. And I think about it because when my daughter was little, she was like one of those kids where you had to put the same.
That is not where I expected you to go.
No, this is where we're going with this, Brad, because we would have to put this movie on heavy rotation, right? And I never paid attention to this movie. I just, you know, I would make dinner, the movie. And then one day I did pay attention to it. And the entire movie was about how the ants worked for the grasshoppers, because the grasshoppers were big and they were terrified of them. And that's what they did day in and day out. They collected food and left it for the grasshoppers, until one ant said, you know what? Yeah, we're small, but there's a lot more of us than them. And the end of the movie, they all stood up for themselves. The grasshoppers left, you know, the end, you know, Disney, great. And I think of us all the time. There are way more of us than there are of them. And when I say us, I mean everyone existing in a school building, every human being that is there for the purpose of kids. There are more of us than there are your board members, your superintendent, your politicians, your Department of Education's. And if we all stood together and said, and I'm not talking about striking, I'm talking about bringing to light the things that are happening in the school that should not be happening. IEP meetings that are not being handled legally the way they should. I've talked to countless special education teachers that tell me the things that we're doing wrong inside of schools for special education students. The funding is wrong. The support is wrong. And we don't bring it out there because obviously, and I get it, we're terrified to lose our jobs. But when there's a lot of us saying, listen, we have broken computers in our schools. We're holding our computers together with masking tape. And our district just got an additional $4 million from the state. And they used it to buy upper admin jobs. Nobody knows that. So tell the paper that. So write an op-ed. Go to the board meeting. Talk to parents. We need to be vocal. We have to start screaming. There are people that want to change the game and make it better for kids, but they have to find each other. And I see this slow movement happening on Twitter sometimes when you kind of spark a conversation and you see these kind of individuals rise up and say, yeah, I don't like this either. And how do we change and what can we do? And I don't believe that we don't have the power to do something. I believe that we can make change. But we have to hold hands. We have to be strong. And we have to remember there is more of us than them.
So to play off your metaphor yeah. here, you know, in a bug's life, it requires one ant with outside the box thinking to recognize that there was a change here. So in education, who is our flick?
I think we have flicks in every building. I think we have flicks in every state. And what I think the power, and I always like talk about Twitter. The other day, my friend is like, ugh, like if Twitter's not paying you, stop talking about Twitter. But it is that one forum that so many educators are on that you start to see the people willing to fight. And it's finding them. It's reaching out to them. It's forming networks. It's having conversations. And then it's not stopping there. It's encouraging them to go to their Board of Ed meetings, to stand up at the podium as a teacher and say, I just want you to know that this is going on in this building. And I hope their union is as good as my union was and is strong enough to back them up. And I know that that's not always the case, but I am a firm believer that a strong union is a teacher's best friend. And I will repeat that it has to be a strong union and not a, you know what I mean? Like, I know unions that are nightmares, and I know that they're the opposite of what a union should be. I had a wonderful union. My state has a wonderful union, and I wouldn't have survived without it. And I think that to feel empowered to make a change, you have to have either your admin support or union support or someone to stand behind you and say, go ahead, say everything that you think is wrong, tell everyone, and I will support you in this path forward. But I do think there are flicks in every school, and I think there's flicks in every state. I think there are people that maybe don't see any problem and they're fine. But most people that I worked with, there was always an issue. I had a girlfriend reach out to me today and send me a message. She listened to my podcast and she said, I can't do another minute. I can't do another minute. And I said, well, what's going on? She's like, it's nothing. It's not the kids. It's not anything else. She goes, it's the curriculum. It's trying to get everything done. It's the paperwork. I can't keep up. And I have heard that story time and time again. And there's no reason why a group of teachers can't sit down and say, we need to take something away. We need a break here, or we need to rethink this curriculum because all of us are going to leave if we don't. And we don't think we can do this, but we can. I don't see why we can't.
Yeah. It's a, you know what? I like your metaphor. I would not have probably made the connection between A Bug's Life and education the way you did, but I see it. I get it.
Yeah.
And you're right. There has to come that point. And I guess when I ask what is our path forward instead of what do we need to do, there are moments where I start to despair and believe that there is nothing we can do at this point. And, you know, we almost in a horrible and dark kind of way have to let it deteriorate so bad before we're not the only ones as educators screaming, this is broken.
Well, and that's very true. And I think that what we have done is become these isolated pockets of people that care about kids. As teachers, we look at parents as this separate entity. You know, there's parents and there's teachers. The parents do think exactly as we do. And when they think negatively about a teacher, it's because they don't know. And I'm dealing with that now, even with my own sisters and their dealings with school. And like, well, the teacher said this. And it's like, well, she did because, you know, you have to understand there's 25 other kids, or, you know, they don't understand how stressful our jobs are. And we fear them because they can get us in trouble and they can give us a hard time. And if we band together with the groups that do care ultimately about the kids, it makes us that much stronger. And I always told my parents, you're the boss. Anything you want, we can give you. You just have to tell us. And if we can band together with a strong group, like parents, like the PTAs, like the statewide agencies that support parents, we would be that much stronger. I mean, you're talking about the majority of the population when you talk about teachers and parents. You know, that is a huge, huge section of your state population that are in it for the kids. And you're going to have, you're going to have these pockets of people that are angry and frustrated and hate you no matter what. But there's more parents and teachers that are believing the same thing or have the same agenda. I just don't think they realize they do. And that's why teachers need to go to their PTA meetings. And that's why parents need to come in more and have more access without us getting so worried about their judgment. We need to create more of a partnership with parents and teachers because we need them to help us.
That may be a perfect segue into my second question. And
okay.
It may not be. Maybe it's a terrible segue and I'm just not good at being a podcast host. Who knows? We'll figure out where it goes. My second question for all my guests is, what is something you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
Shout. And I'm not in the classroom anymore. It's easy for me to do that. And I'm not working for the state anymore. And it's easy for me to do that. But stop putting the blinders on and pretending like there isn't nonsense happening. And maybe it's not happening in your school, but it's happening in the school down the road from you. We cannot be teachers isolated inside of a cinder block room, inside of a cinder block school, and not know that 5 miles down the road in a poverty-stricken neighborhood is a school that does not have the same resources as you. If you are in this for the kids, you are in this for all kids. You have to speak up. It is your duty to speak up. And that's what frustrates me about teachers. And when I go on Twitter, I have no time anymore for rainbows and butterflies. And, you know, I woke up and I was born to be a teacher and the love quotes. Yeah, that's great. So help everyone else feel the same way. Help every kid have access to the programs and the resources that your kids have access to. If you are an absolute educator, then you care about the education of every child in the state that you work in the country that you live in, around the world. And if you're there for the 20 kids that are in your room, you are not doing your job. That is not why we are here. And we are smart and we're powerful. And I am sick of the cowardice behavior. And I don't mean to sound so mean about it, but come on, people. You cannot be frustrated and you cannot leave your job crying and go back in the next day and not talk and not try and do something about it. That's what I wish everyone would do. Start talking about what's wrong. And if you can't find something wrong in your building, then help somebody else in another building. Be support, make a PLN, offer services, offer books out of your library that your kids aren't touching anymore to another library in another school. I mean, pay it forward. Do something. But don't just teach kids from 9 to 3. We are smarter than that. We are stronger than that. And we can offer so much more. Those are the stories that should be in the paper.
It's interesting because, you know, I feel that pressure on both sides. I shouldn't say that. That's inaccurate. I say whatever I think. It often gets me in trouble, both online and in person.
I hear you.
But I also know that I'm, number one, not the norm. Just personality-wise, ignoring the fact that I'm a teacher, just as a personality trait, other people don't always act that way in their real lives.
Right.
And I also know as a teacher, I regularly get pressure to stop doing exactly that, especially as I have embarked on this educational master's program where I'm in ed leadership and looking at going into admin, and my principal and APs and people around me are saying, you got to learn to filter. You got to learn to filter because you never know who you're going to offend. And every ounce of my being just wants to say, if I offended them, I probably don't want to work for them anyways.
I know.
But I also know that that can be a short-sighted view. So there is a balance you have to strike there.
100%. You got to play. You have to play the game to some extent. And when I remember saying something like, people have to speak up, and someone kind of came at me and they're like, you know, you're telling people to speak up and they're going to lose their jobs. And I thought, you know, you don't give people enough credit. I don't understand how a passionate teacher that wants to do well or sees something that their kids don't have in their classroom and asks for it at a board meeting or asks their admin or writes a letter to their superintendent and says, I don't have a proper library, or I want to change this language arts curriculum because it's not fitting my kids. I can't follow this pacing guide. If someone is going to come down on someone else and say, you shouldn't have said that, the things that would affect your students directly, what are we doing here? Like, that's where I get confused. And you and I are very much the same. I've never had, obviously, that personality. I'm not a type A. I never did a bulletin board. I had no idea how to have proper handwriting. I didn't do anchor. I just did what I felt was right. And I loved my kids and we had a great time and they thrived, but I didn't do it the way it looked like everyone else did it. And I was loud. And I did talk about what was wrong, but I was the minority there. You know, that wasn't a common attribute of a teacher. But I think slowly I'm starting to see that it's becoming more and more so, where people are getting fed up and they're getting tired. And instead of me getting burned out and retiring, leaving the job because I couldn't do it one more day, I would hope that someone does it better than me. And instead of that, takes charge and says, you know what? Let me see if I can fix this before I have to go.
It's interesting that you connect that back to sort of the burnout idea, that idea that we're just, there is a too much is too much, you know?
Yeah, and, there absolutely is. Yeah.
And for me, I can't speak for you, but for me, this podcast and just accepting that my voice is polarizing and it is going to push people in a direction or another, and just accepting that has revitalized my love for this career and this field and what I do every day.
I have the exact same thing. I think when I did Shane's episode and that came out, and then doing my own podcast and saying what I feel, knowing that people will either not like it or judge me or just, and accepting that has made me not only a stronger person, but a person that's way more reinvigorated to stay in this career and to keep doing the good work, regardless of what anyone's opinion is. The people that matter to me are the people that live the closest to me, the people that I see on a daily basis. Somebody's judgment, I disagree with this or that, or I could care less. And it's really one of those things that has become so powerful. And the more you speak out and the more backlash you get for it, I'm telling you, it's a gift. It's a gift because you get so much stronger in handling it and processing it. I mean, 5 years ago, I was in a fetal position on my bed crying and sobbing from someone judging me. And that is just that's not even ever going to happen again because I know exactly who I am. I know who I'm not. And what I'm here to do isn't for everyone else. My love of education is to make it better for the people that are in it. But everything I say it comes from my heart. It's what I believe in. And even when I say things on Twitter and people are like, I absolutely disagree with you, I'll respond and I'll say, all right. Oh, so Chris, I could care less. Do your thing. You know what I mean? I'm not changing anything. I'm not your principal. I'm not your superintendent. If you want to give out homework and I think homework is stupid, great. Give it out. Do your thing.
We do not have time to start discussing the equity of homework. I don't have.
Oh my God. It's my next episode. Just wait. I have kids on it. It's so adorable.
It's been discussed on my show a couple times at this point, and I'm just over it. I'm just over it.
Yeah, beat a dead horse. I know. So
why do we keep doing it? I don't understand. There's no support. I don't either. Stop it. Let it go.
And just let it go. I've never done it. I've never had backlash for not doing it. I was also in elementary school. But at the same time, I'm just talking about the equity of it. And I think that's in my next episode. If you do give it out, just don't grade it. You know what I mean? Like, does it have to be graded? Does it have to be scored? And I don't know. But
it's how my son's, you're right. That's my a whole son's other first animal. Grade teacher does it that way, where it's given as like sort of an optional if you want to do
it's
it.
It's an option. And right.
I think my son does it at his after school program sometimes, but I don't actually ask.
Right.
You know, so I don't really know. I'm not really that worried about it. So
me neither. I'm the same way with that.
It's interesting.
I mean, there's times where my child has had so much homework that I've written on the top. She will not be doing this. I'm not going to have her sit for 5 hours at the dining room table laying on top of 6 worksheets that have all asked the same questions. So it's just a waste of time.
Agree. It's funny. And now we're going to completely sidetrack because that seems like a good idea. My new thing with my son, because he's in first grade, so he's 6. He doesn't remember anything 5 seconds after it happens. And so
of course,
that's something we're working on. We're working on remembering things, identifying things that are important or not. And so I've learned that much more successful than simply asking him, how was your day or what did you learn, is giving him 2 specific questions to answer every day. And mm-hmm. he knows I drill them on when I drop them off at school, when I pick them up. What are the 2 questions? What are the 2 questions? What are your answers? And the 2 questions are always, what was your favorite thing you learned today? And
aww.
Why were you on the color and the behavior chart that you were? And this is part
of... Oh, please don't.
I agree. The behavior chart's insane. It's seven. It's seven tiers. The behavior chart he's on is on seven tiers. It goes red, orange, yellow, green. Roy G. Red, orange, yellow, green, and green is sort of neutral. Blue, so far so good. Like, okay, first of all, we already have too many tiers for first graders, but all right, at least we're doing like a rainbow thing. I get it, Roy G. B. But then it falls apart, and it's purple and pink at the top two levels, and now I'm confused by the color spectrum and the decision to have seven levels of performance in a first grade classroom, and he can never tell me why he's on the color he's on. And it's ridiculous. So now it's, why are you on that color? I don't even care what color you're on. Just tell me why. If you're on red and you can tell me these are the things I did wrong, you're probably not going to do them again. I'm not going to lose sleep over it. But the thing about it is I always tell them, and I started once we sort of the first week or so of doing the two questions, I said, okay, out of curiosity, buddy, which one of those do you think is more important? Then, of course, right away, he said, why am I on that color? And I said, absolutely not. And he goes, huh?
Right.
And I said, no, the what you learned is way more important. And he's like, really? And
well,
obviously.
Yeah. And this is what we have done
to the school.
Yeah. And this is what we have done to six-year-old kids that get picked up from school. It's the first thing my nephew talks about is what color he's on. And I thought, how is this archaic practice still happening in 2019? How is there a behavior chart, a public behavior chart on the wall? I do not know. And that's the type of stuff that drives me crazy. Practices that we know are not good for kids are happening all up. Will your son be fine next year? Absolutely. But it's for this year, he will care every time that clip moves up and down those colors. He will know whether he's good, bad. It's almost this definition of what he is based on what the teacher believes he is. And these little kids start to believe that. I'm not good. I am bad. I am good. Or that kid's always on the purple color. Like, it's just nonsense. And it's a lazy way to control your classroom. There are way more research-based and thoughtful behavior management systems that do not include public shaming. And that is absolutely what that is. And it drives me crazy.
I've gotten really bad this year about not insulting the behavior system when I explain it to other people. Even when my son's around,
I know.
I don't think he knows the definition of the word asinine, so it's working out really well so far.
Yeah, I love that word. Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
But he's way too smart for his own good, so he could very well know what it means. And even if he doesn't, the first time he walks into class and tells his teacher, my daddy says this behavior system is asinine.
I know. Oh, my gosh. And that was always hard for me as a teacher, too, and with my girls, and knowing certain things that were like, what? Like, this is so archaic. And, you know, I also know that's the teacher's classroom, and that's their rules. And I was never a parent that would call a teacher or fight about, you know, unless it was something serious, but it never got to that. It just... You see things done that you would absolutely never do in your classroom, but you got to swallow hard on some things.
I'm not good at that. And
I know, I hear you.
I've said before there's a storm of brewing in my son's educational career. And so far we're okay. This is the second year. While I don't agree with the behavior system, I'm not going to lose. It's probably not equitable. I'm sure there are kids who are suffering from it, but it's not my kid. So it's
I hear you.
It's hypocritically okay for me right now.
Yes. Absolutely.
But we're going to get to a point real soon here. Because one of the big ones for me, and I think I've talked about this in the show, so audience, sorry, don't care. Mary and I are talking. Just keep listening. is, you know, AR is a thing at his school. And my son loves to read. He loves stories. And he gets that from me. But I was never really particularly motivated by AR. And none of the research really supports AR as a long-term motivation strategy for encouraging lifelong learners. So it's coming. We're coming to a point where a teacher is going to try to tell him that his grade is going to be based on AR. And I'm going to say, no, it's not. And you're not going to grade him that way. And it's, you know, it's going to be one of those things where I'm going to have a sit down with a principal and, you know, it's going to be a thing. I know it's coming and it's probably next year. So I'm like prepping myself for it emotionally and physically. So it's going to be fun.
I know.
Well, we just took like a 20-minute detour that had nothing to do with my show, but we're going to leave it in anyways. And I appreciate your honesty. I really do. But I do, to get back to your point, I think you're right that we really do need to, as a field, speak up. In fact, I essentially presented on this at ISTE this past summer, where I said it is really essential that as educators, we start to speak up, but also just have the discussions with each other, because I don't even think we're doing that for the most part. You know, we're kind of frustrated and complaining a lot, but I don't think that's the same thing as having a real conversation about what we want to see change.
Yeah, I agree.
And until we do that and we are a unified voice, you know, at one point you said that, you know, if we are the ants in this metaphor, yes, we drastically outnumber the grasshoppers, the whatever,
yeah, we do.
Whoever you want to define the grasshoppers are, whether it's the 1%, whether it's whatever the political party, whatever it may be, until we can agree to vote as a block, that doesn't matter.
Yep.
And that's why politicians ignore teachers, because we don't vote together. We vote as disparate interests. And we, while we are a significant percentage, we don't vote as a significant percentage. And so we don't have a voice.
And what's happened, I mean, even we had a local mayor's election here in the town that I live in, and my union backed a party that typically unions don't back. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, when did we all get together and say we were going to vote for this guy? And when did we all like decide that this is how we were going to lead politically? And when did we get involved in politics? And there were things like that that would happen. And we just didn't say anything. And I always look back at those moments like, how could I have not said absolutely not? How did I not get more involved? And I think you're so overwhelmed and you're so caught up in your own. It's easy for me to sit here and say, guys, fight. But I don't have 25 kids and I don't have grades due in a week and I don't have lesson plans to write. And I know that that takes up so much time that by the end of the day, the powers that be are pleased that you are that drained enough to not fight. They know that. And the ancillary work and the nonsense work that takes up most of our time, at the end of the day, I don't know that many people have anything left to fight with. So it's an interesting situation that we're all in.
It almost makes me wonder if that's intentional on some level.
I always think that. I always think that. They know exactly what they're doing. And they assert authority every now and then with our contracts. And I know I've talked to a few people. I had no idea that tenure and non-tenure depended on the state. I had no idea you could be a non-tenure teacher forever, which would have to completely change the game here in New Jersey. But
raising my hand over here, which you can't see, but
yeah,
I will never have tenure in the state of Florida. So it's totally,
I cannot imagine. And that's very indicative of the state that New Jersey is and the union that we have. We have one of the strongest unions in the nation. I mean, the NJEA is powerful. I do not have a problem with my local union. I see corruption and a lot of money being made at the top? Absolutely. But I can't complain in terms of my representation and what they did for us locally, for us teachers. But we were bound by our contract and our superintendent knew it. And he would get things in there to negotiate with the union, because if we wanted a higher salary or we wanted benefits, well, then we were going to give things up. So we lost a lot of control. And they knew exactly what they were doing with making sure we knew who was really in charge. And it was fear. We worked in fear at all times. And I think when you have tenure and non-tenure, and if you have no tenure at all, you must work in fear all the time. This is not a job that you lose and you just get it another one. You know what I mean? It's just, it's any public service job. That's why it should be unionized. It's a very hard job to get once you lose it.
Yeah. Yeah, I probably should have more fear for what I do, but I don't think I'm doing
your thing. I love how you're doing it.
I don't think I'm smart enough to be afraid of that situation.
I hear me neither, my friend, me neither.
So, well, you know, Mayor, it's been a phenomenal conversation, but we have one question left to get to. We have to get one more.
Yeah.
And we're coming up on 50 minutes, so we gotta hit this one.
Okay, I want to answer it really quickly.
No, take your time with it. We can go for an hour and a half. It's my show. I can make it as long as I want. Rule one of podcasting. It's your show. Do whatever you want.
I hear you.
So my last question for all my guests is, who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
My 7th grade science teacher. I'm gonna even say my 5th grade teacher, Mrs. Wachstein. And I share this story all the time. I had a great 7th grade science teacher, Mrs. Kochka, but Mrs. Wachstein was my 5th grade teacher, and she made me feel loved. And I came from a really good family, and I was loved immensely by my mom and dad. I didn't need to be loved by another person, but it felt amazing. And I can tell you nothing that we did. I can't tell you a trip. I can't tell you a project, nothing. But I know how I felt in that room every day. And I felt loved and safe. And I adored that woman. And she was someone that I went back every year to see and visit and hug. And she was just absolutely, she just radiated love. And when I taught, I tried to emulate her. And I mean, I just am a loving person anyway. But if I did anything right when I taught, it was loved my kids. I screwed lessons up. I never handed in lesson plans to my admin. I was just the worst at any sort of like housekeeping nonsense. But I loved my kids. They felt loved. They knew they were loved. And it was the only thing I knew I did right. And I know I got that from her.
That's interesting. I like that. I do. I think it's, you know, for what was a intense and passionate episode with lots of ideas thrown around and just, you know, a lot of, I feel like sometimes screaming into the void, but hopefully a void that's listening on occasion.
Yeah.
It's kind of a beautiful, simple sentiment to end an episode on. I kind of like it.
And the end of the day in this job, it's what you need the most of in order to survive it, in order to appreciate it. You know, if you don't have love for the job and love for the people in the room and the people that you work with, I don't know how else you would get it done. And I don't know why else you would stay.
Yeah. You know what? I can't wrap it up better myself. We're gonna just leave it. I like it. Mayor, thank you so much. When I messaged you while I listened to Shane's episode, I expected a ball of energy and just an intense moment of recording, and I was not disappointed and got exactly what I expected, and I love that. And I appreciate you for that. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
How can my audience get a hold of you if they have more questions?
So they can always reach out to me on Twitter. My handle is at Mayor, M-A-I-R-E, Cervenak, C-E-R-V-E-N-A-K. My podcast is linked in the bio. You can DM me questions. I support teachers all the time through DMs. But all of my work and everything that I'm doing is up on Twitter.
Perfect. That makes it nice and easy. Yeah. And of course, links to that as well as her podcast and the podcast episode she was on with Shane, where she in way more detail describes her story and how she got to be where she is, which sounds way more ominous, I feel like, than it is, except it kind of also is ominous. I don't know.
No, it's definitely a good, it's a story that people need to hear. It was a story that I waited 5 years to finally share with a lot of people, and it's a story for everyone. It's really not just a matter of people that have been in any similar situation. It's just a story of surviving something that you can't control. So
And regardless of whether you go back and listen, just if you take nothing else away, take away the importance of sharing your story. Because
absolutely.
If we all sit here and stay quiet, then we are nothing more than the headlines that get posted. So
absolutely.
I think that's important. Mare, thank
you. Yeah, take control of your story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Have a great night.
Mare, thank you so much for your honesty during this chat. It was a lot of fun and had some great points to ponder. To connect with Mare, find her on Twitter at Mare Cervic, and check out her podcast, Faculty Room, which you can find on Anchor FM or by clicking the link in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Shuffler. I love to hear from you there, and it's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or, if you don't do those, you can always check out my feedback page on the website, which gives you additional options for feedback, and you can find that at bradshuffler.com/feedback. Until next week, be the flick in your building. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.